from Professor Julia Steinberger. She researches ecological economics at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland after doing a PhD in experimental physics. And today we will have a very nice talk with the title Living with Well Within the Limits. Is this possible and what will it take? And I think it would be best if I just let her start sharing and give us a great talk for the start of the day.
Hi, everybody. Thanks, Stefania. Thanks, Shreyasi. Thanks, everybody, for being here. Okay, so off we go. And I'm assuming that we have about an hour, and a lot of that should be discussion, right? That's correct. Okay. All right. So, and we will now do the screen sharing thing. Which is not, there we go. Okay, so you should be able to share to see the screen.
Yes, that's perfect.
Fantastic. And I'll hide this stuff and give myself a time. Okay. I guess one of the things I should say is that it's very nice to be talking to physicists. I used to be one of you, not a particle physicist, but I did do a PhD in physics, and then I drifted away more and more. And I guess I should just say a few things about my drifting, because it sort of took a path that maybe physicists would recognize, which is that when I decided I wanted to start looking at sustainability and environmental things, I decided I didn't want to look at technology per se, or work on technological development, which would have been maybe a logical direction, because it seemed to me that the technological development was not, it was already pretty clear 20 years ago that technologies were pretty great, and they've only gotten more fantastic since then. I guess I hope Ruth showed some of that. I'm sure she did. And that what we're really sort of facing is we're facing problems of the economy and our political system. And so what I started wanting to do was sort of trying to understand what is the scope of the issue. And the scope of the issue, the way I decided to look at that was using a topic called through the lens of a field called industrial ecology. And industrial ecology tries to consider societies, economies, cities, whatever your unit is, through the lens of a material and flow analysis. And there's this idea of social metabolism, which is that you can consider, you can analyze a society from the scale and composition, the way it uses the resources in the environment, the way it uses trade, et cetera. And when I was doing industrial ecology, I was doing what everybody is doing in industrial ecology, or was doing at the time. I think since then people have moved on because basically we didn't find it, which is looking for green growth. It was like, okay, where do we find evidence that our economies can continue to function and decrease our re impacts on the environment fast enough to avoid, planetary breakdown? And we did not find that. I didn't find that to my satis you know, I satisfied myself that this was not a thing that existed in reality. Around 2010, I was pretty satisfied from my own research and from the research of colleagues that this was just not a thing. And this evidence has, I would say, gotten stronger since. So then I started looking at, but what I did find is what I'm going to be talking about in this talk, which is that if you look at indicators that are not GDP, that are not economic growth, if you look at indicators that have to do with quantity and quality of life, you do actually find really strong evidence of decoupling and really strong evidence that of potential of living well at much lower resource use. And then that asks the big question, which is why aren't we doing it? Which is a political question. It's a distribution question. It's inequality. It's power. It's wealth. And what do we need to do to challenge that? So how do we get to this place, to this point, where we could in fact be providing good living conditions for everybody at much lower resource use? And this is what the talk is about. And I hope you don't see the annoying rectangle. You see the whole screen, right? I hope. Okay.
So you can see the full screen, but first slide.
Yeah, that's great. We're going to start with a bit of a I think Shreyas said that we should be optimistic. I have to admit that I am not. So I think that the evidence is very clear that we are headed for a cataclysm. The obviously climate change is real and the impacts are devastating. And I think so one of the things I want you to take away from this slide, and it's something that we learn far too little about for, in the physicist community, is the long history of the planet and the long history of human existence, Homo sapiens, and who we are and what we've been doing around. And so one of the things that I'll use this plot, even though it's from the already from an IPCC report that's already 7 years old, is because it shows the Holocene temperature range in pink. And what zero is on the vertical axis is the baseline temperature, which is pre-industrial, before, you know, we started burning lots of coal in the UK and other places. And the Holocene temperature range is extremely narrow. And the Holocene temperature, so it's about a degree, right? You see it in pink. And the Holocene range is extremely narrow, and it's the temperature range that humanity and the planet have existed in since the last ice age about 10 to 12,000 years ago. And in that temperature range, that very narrow, stable, sort of warmish temperature range compared to the ice age, that's where humanity has flourished and thrived and done crazy things like invent agriculture, which is one technology we think we know how to use, but we are sort of dismantling the conditions of. We developed cities, we developed writing, all of that stuff happened since the end of the last age during the Holocene, and that is not a coincidence. So humanity and our current conditions of life are entirely dependent on this very narrow planetary stability. And as you can see, we're absolutely shooting out of it. Last year was the first year above 1.5 degrees already. And so we're shooting, you know, and we've shot out of it at a speed that is in geological terms extraordinarily rapid. And this means that ecosystems don't have a chance to adapt, and probably our agriculture systems do not either. And the importance of getting back or staying as close as possible to Holocene temperature range cannot be overstated. And that's what the 1.5 degree target is about. And so the quote of Deborah Roberts, the co-chair of Working Group 2, that the next few years are the most important in our history. This is not a joke. This is not just the history of, you know, the recent couple of 100 years, whatever, couple past decades. It's the history of our species. So this is not to be underestimated. And what this already looks like, it looks like this. It looks like cataclysm in various places around the world. This is a weather event where basically climate change is disrupting major weather patterns, which means that, and it also causes heavier downpours. And this is a combination of the two. This is a downpour that dumped several months' worth of rain over a couple of days in Greece. And that water is not supposed to be there. That's not like the Mediterranean or anything. And that's a major agri the large agri most important agricultural region in Greece. It will never be as productive as it was before this event. But in Greece, despite the va magnitude of this cataclysm, nobody really died, which was not the case for the same weather event in Derna, Libya, so, which is so just across the Mediterranean. And in Dur this is probably the deadliest climate incident. Nobody has really maybe heard of it or remembers it because it happened in Libya. And it was a predicted accident. What happened was a dam failed, and that dam was known to be at risk. That dam was, and there were papers published on the risks that this dam posed to the city. There was a poet, a very famous Libyan poet who lived in the city, who predicted the day of the big of the flood. In one of his poems, and he died along with 10 upwards of 10,000 people overnight in this flood. And this is what, you know, our landscape looks like in already. And this year, of course, the, you know, it's always coming close to home somewhere. This was in Los Angeles earlier this year. And one of the reasons it touched me, and I'm including this sort of frame in all my talks, is because in Los Angeles, the fire swept through Altadena. And Altadena is a historically black neighborhood, and it is the place where Octavia Butler is buried. And Octavia Butler, if you take one thing away from this talk, the only thing is do yourself a far favor and go and get The Parable of the Sower and read it. She wrote about dis sort of science fiction, dystopian fiction. She was an extremely just, you cannot overstate how important and intelligent and great
And
Octavia
great
Butler
Octavia
is.
Butler is.
And
And
I'm sorry, I'm
I'm
getting an
sorry, I'm getting
echo.
an echo.
Jie Gao, do you think you could turn off your microphone? Hello? Okay, so I hope that that worked.
Sorry.
No worries. Okay, so hopefully the echo is gone. And so one of the things Octavia Butler did is she even in the subsequent book to this predicted Trump, including the Make America Great autocratic trend, et cetera. And she talks about what it's like to be human in an era when things are sort of crashing around you, down around you. And I think that that's sort of an important thing we need to be thinking about. So now I will get to sort of the more scientific content of things. And I'll talk to you about some stylized facts on energy and well-being. So this is the kind of stuff I was studying and researching around 2010-ish, so already about 25 years ago. But I th and other people were studying earlier, but it's still not stuff that most people know about and understand, I think, despite its importance. So we'll just go over the basics. The first stylized fact is that beyond a certain level, energy increases do not result in measurably higher well-being, and this result has been known since the year I was born. I am 51. It was known, published in Science in 1974. And this is a great article. You can go and read it. It's splendid in lots of ways. And yes, massive energy consumption is not necessary at all for well-being. And what it looks like in terms of data, and this plot is a sort of oldie and goldie favorite of mine, but it doesn't matter what you put on the vertical axis in terms of a well-being metric. It doesn't matter what you put on the horizontal axis as an energy per capita metric. This plot always kind of looks the same. It's always this this sort of very flat curve that, I mean, is very steep at the beginning, where a little goes a long way in terms of increasing, having a high correlation with increasing well-being, increasing human development in this case. And then it just sort of flattens out and it just does not matter anymore. Over almost an order of magnitude of energy use, you just, that's it. And the other interesting thing that even fewer people know and understand is that there's this dynamic decline. So the energy threshold associated with any given level of well-being is decreasing dramatically over time, in such a way that you can actually do sort of projections with it. So this was a paper I published in 2010, so already a little while ago, but this trend is just very, very, very steady. And people have run scenarios based on it. So the fact is that we're one of the things that we learned in this article is that whereas we used to be in the 1970s in a situation where the energy requirements for universal high human development would have been something like twice as much energy as was globally consumed available, that situation changed dramatically over time. Not because our energy consumption is increasing, because that's staying relatively constant per capita, going up a bit, but because the energy requirements of well-being are dropping so fast. And so that's what's the thing that's really changing dynamically is our ability to deliver high human development at low energy use. And this is a splendid, great thing, and we should take advantage of it. So we've gone from a situation of constraint to a situation of distribution, right? That's the issue. If we want to go beyond these sort of black box results, resource in, well-being out, we have to have an analytic framework. This is the one that we developed for the Living Well Within Limits project. And basically, it's quite simple. You have sort of your biophysical issues on the left-hand side, you have your social outcomes on the right-hand side. And in the middle, we decided not to put economy, we decided not to put technology. In the middle, we decided to put this object of heterodox economics, so non-mainstream economics, which is called provisioning systems. And the idea there is you can study physical and social objects together and try to understand how they interact. And I'll get into what that allows us to say a bit later. But for now, I am going to tell you about well-being and how we study that. So we had to go and read stuff from way back. And yes, this is Western-oriented direction. There are other directions, but the fact is that a couple thousand years ago, people were saying interesting things about what they thought about the human condition and human well-being. And so Aristotle was one of the first ones to sort of articulate it. And for him, our well-being was living life fully as possible. It's a very active notion, and to flourish within society is a very social notion. And Aristotle's great. I follow Aristotle. Full disclosure. He writes, it should be noted that he writes this in the Ethics a few pages after his justification of slavery and a few pages before his justification of women staying in the kitchen or the other way around. Anyway, don't take everything he says for granted. And then Epicure has a much more, a few decades later, has a much more emotional perspective on well-being. It's about feelings. It's about positive feelings, negative feelings, and is very much individual. And as in all good academic disputes, the two camps persist to this day. What happened to Epicure's ideas was not what he would have wanted, but it's sort of the dominant perspective. So Team Epicure has this perspective on well-being that's sort of this emotional state, sort of like happiness. It's an individual perspective. You measure it as like the happiness indicator, going around asking people how happy they are. Or if you're in a mainstream economist, you use the utility function. You basically say people go out and maximize utility by spending whatever budget they have in the market. And in that view, the way you see the economy is that more economic growth is good because more economic growth means more income, means more consumption, means more positive feelings. And that's the dominant view in everything that is happening all around us and in the decisions that are being made by policymakers and businesses that determine our lives. If you're on Team Aristotle, your view is very different. Well-being is a flourishing. It's about flourishing in society. It's an active perspective. It's social. Whatever the even if you use a single dimension, generally you're using a multidimensional way of thinking about it, like the Human Development Index or the Sustainable Development Goals or other frameworks like capabilities. The view of the economy is very different. So if you've ever read Amartya Sen, so the great Indian economist, Nobel Prize winner, and so on, one of the good economics Nobel Prize winners, should be said, the view on the economy is that it is only justified, to economic decision making is only justified if it supports human potential, if it supports human beings flourishing, being able to make life plans in our societies. It is not justified as an end in itself, only as a means to an end. And of course, as you can tell by this description, we decided to be on Team Aristotle, and we wrote a couple of papers about this. So you don't have to, you can just go and see what we were thinking about if you want to go and look at those papers. Now, as physicists, you might think, does this matter? Who cares? And also, can it be tested? And so, can we test Aristotle's theory? And indeed, we do our best to try. And what we're doing here is we're using the theory of human need, which is an Aristotelian eudaimonic, is the technical term framework, where we basically say human well-being is built up from human need satisfiers. So you need to satisfy a certain finite number of human needs. You don't need to do more than satisfy them. So this is a perspective that has satiability and sufficiency baked into it. So we tried to test this. What we did is we looked at average life satisfaction. So this is one of the, how satisfied are you with your life on a scale from 1 to 10 versus the number of human need satisfiers achieved. And that's just based on like, are people getting enough food, enough education, et cetera, around the world. And these are national level indicators. So they're national level averages. And this is what we found, which is obviously, correlation is not causation, but this is a pretty strong trend for physical well-being. So average healthy life expectancy versus numbers of human need satisfiers, it's an even stronger result because it actually has some kind of a saturation pattern to it. And since then, so that was in 2018 that we did that work. So this is now a recent result from the REAL project, which is my new research project on looking at post-growth economies. This is the first paper of the PhD of Leah Tamberg. And it's a splendid result. It's on the preprint server if you want to find it. And basically, she's using Gallup World Poll data. So these are, hundreds of data points every year in multiple countries around the world, looking at this subjective aspect of life evaluation. It's like, how are you okay with your life? And finding that the blue curve basically is the model with the blue band is sort of the model with normal economic growth and need satisfaction just being achieved as normal economic growth would allow it. And it's not really a sort of high priority necessarily. The orange one is with individual needs satisfied, and the red one is with individual needs satisfied and everybody's needs satisfied within that society, as well as some good governance parameters. What you can see is that it is all of these curves move upwards and flatten out. Basically, as soon as you start taking need satisfaction into account, at the individual or social level, the importance of economic growth disappears and becomes really a very, very inefficient way of achieving well-being. So the idea here, what we're really showing here, is that Aristotle's perspective is correct, and human need satisfaction is what matters, and it is what our economy should be doing. Once human needs are satisfied, people are able to make life plans. They are okay with their life, and they you don't need more than that for people to really have very high levels of well-being. In fact, higher than would be achieved with economic growth just on its own. Okay, now that's nice in theory, but we also wanted to test whether or not countries are really doing this thing of possibly achieving human need satisfaction within planetary boundaries, within environmental limits. And basically, what we did here is we tested environmental indicators that were consumption-based. They were trade-corrected, which means that we were looking at how much a country really consumes total when you take trade into account, and what their level of well-being, need satisfaction, so their environmental ceiling, their social foundation. And I'm not going to go into great gory detail over this, but the news is bad. Basically, countries come in three flavors. Either they're not damaging the planet, which is, low on the horizontal axis. Sorry, I cut out the legend on the horizontal axis. The horizontal axis is number of biophysical boundaries breached, so number of planetary limits breached. So either they're low on the environmental damage scale and low on the social achievement scale, or they're high on the environmental damage scale and high on the social achievement scale, or they're high on the environmental damage scale and low on the social achievement scale. That's entirely possible. But the neighborhood that's really empty is this sort of little green circle, like the green donut there is where we want to be, with high high social quality and low environmental damage. And then the question is, what do we do about this? Because that's where we all of these countries would want to be going in order for us to have good lives within planetary boundaries. So where do we go from here? And I'll sort of do a whistle stops tour of recent results. The first sort of organized into three facts and three ways forward. So inequality and sufficiency, possibility and investment, and dependency versus economic democracy. The first fact is inequality. So possibly other speakers have talked about this. I don't want to dwell on it too much, but long story short, climate change is a problem that reflects economic inequality. The wealthiest are to blame for the vast majority of it, from their consumption, even worse, from their investments, if you take that into account. In this case, is from a consumption perspective, the top 10%, which probably most people on this call, unless you're PhD students, fall into, are responsible for globally are responsible for about half of global emissions. So we see this huge inequality. The lowest half of humanity, the poorest half of humanity, is responsible for something like less than 10% of global emissions. So we have this huge inequality problem. And I'm not going to go into details on this one. I just want to sort of show you. It's easier to show you, but this is a result that we see. This is a national result. It's for the UK, but it's something that we see internationally
ياسمين
in countries.
الحبيبة ياسمين بقى تما
Hi, Farida. Can you
قلت
block your
الإيمان
microphone? Thank you. This is something that we see internationally. So we see it in the countries we look at, and we see it internationally as well. This is sort of really a universal pattern. So what you see in this plot is that the lowest 10%, and that basically it's the UK population divided by decile. So lowest 10% at the bottom, poorest 10% at the bottom, richest 10% at the top, and what their energy footprints look like. And you can see that housing is remarkably equal. The UK is kind of crazy about this, but other countries are. Housing is one of the most equal energy use categories, and there are reasons for this that we can go into if you want. But this is something we see, and where you really see inequality glumping is transportation. It's flight use, it's car use, it's also public transportation use. And this is so huge. You see the red flights and the orange cars, that in the UK, the richest 10%. Use more energy on flying than the poorest 20% do total. So this is really this huge, huge inequality. that we see. And then the way forward is obviously something like sufficiency that Yamina Saheb talked about. And obviously, she's responsible for the definition that's in the IPCC. So I won't repeat what she said, but basically, we need to move towards reducing this inequality while satisfying everybody's needs. And that's what sufficiency looks like. So the second fact I want to cover is possibility. Is this condition possible or not? And this is one of the things we tried to do in the Living Well Within Limits project, is we wanted to try to model what it would look like for everybody to be fine, have enough, so have high well-being, and at low energy as possible. So we were trying to sort of square that circle and see what it would look like. And one of the things we wanted to do is we wanted to base it on technologies that were super efficient, especially at the end use level, because we have these magical technologies like heat pumps, like induction stoves. So we wanted it to be sort of, high tech in the sense of like we're doing things super efficiently, but then we're everybody has the same energy services. So we're doing this based on the Decent Living Energy Framework of Narasimha Rao of Yale University. And probably one year you should invite him because doing really super interesting stuff. And his framework connects needs to sufficient level of energy services. And then what we did is we sort of took this and made this quite simple global model based on certain technology choices. And everybody has access to the same level of energy services, but these are differentiated by, for instance, if you're younger or older, you have different food requirements. If you're living in a rural place, you have more transportation requirements than if you're living in an urban setting and things are closer to you. And we took into account embodied energy. We took into account the energy required to build up infrastructure, public spaces. We only had schools and hospitals, but we at least tried to represent those in some way, and private consumption. And so off we go. Oh yeah, so this is, and everybody has a laptop. Everybody has a phone. Well, every household has a laptop. Every person has a phone with data. So the it's not luxury. 15 square meters per person is a lot less than most of us, myself included, live in. But that living space is heated and cooled to 20 degrees year round. So which is huge levels of comfort. If you live in the UK, you know what I'm talking about. So this is a lot better life than a lot of people are living in. And obviously, if you have space that is not necessarily heated or cooled to that level, then you can make the space bigger, right? So that's another thing. So it's an estimate. It was a first try. And what this looks like is that so here what this plot shows is final energy demand. We didn't want to look at primary energy for reasons I can get into, but primary energy is basically a bad place to start making estimates and decisions because right now it's dominated by fossil fuel use, and fossil fuels are comically, stupidly inefficient. The loss rates from what you are using the energy for to what you want to do with it are upward, 2/3 is normal, basically, certainly upwards of a half. So we wanted to look at final energy, electricity, and things like that because that's a more sensible place to start thinking about stuff. And this is, you see the sort of international, so that's in exajoules on the horizontal, on the vertical axis. And you can see the International Energy Agency, so the IEA reference sort of has us cruising upwards, and upwards of 400 exajoules, which is where we are now. And our result showed that it would be possible to satisfy everybody's needs despite population growth at around 160 exajoules. So a huge amount lower based on feasible technologies. And one of the things that's important about this is that this scenario might sound crazy and either utopian or dystopian, depending on your views on inequality, I guess. But everybody's okay. This is a scenario where, based on feasible technologies, everybody is okay. Nobody is suffering from deprivation. Nobody is unhealthy. Everybody is fine. And it's based on feasible technologies, which the IPCC scenarios are not, because of their wild, wild dependence on negative, the so-called, get out of jail free card of negative emission technologies, which don't exist in reality. And this is a huge problem that we have within the IPCC and sort of policy guidance, is that we have this huge amount of negative emissions, which, maybe in 1990 that was a reasonable thing to sort of have as a possibility, but it is no longer the case. Nobody could claim that these things are on the horizon or about to become important at all. And we need to act fast. So it's much more important to act fast and reducing energy demand than it is to act to imagine that, in a couple of years we're going to have gigatons and gigatons of negative emissions. Okay, that was sort of a side point. What does this mean, though? What would this world require, sort of physically, in terms of our economies? And this is a beautiful paper that I cannot recommend too highly by Jarmo Kickstra and colleagues, also involving Narasimha Rao. One of the things that Jarmo did in this paper is try to estimate how much energy it would take. So again, in biophysical terms, material terms, to get to a future where people would be able to live at low energy, because it actually takes a lot of investment, right? You're talking about really high levels of energy efficiency in housing and transportation, building up public transportation capacity, all of this stuff, new appliances, heat pumps, all of this, right? And what you can see is the investment on the end use side is huge. It's on the order of 290 exajoules, which is large. It's roughly, as you saw in the last plot, a year of final energy use globally. But that's spread over a couple of decades, right? So it's big, it's a huge effort, but it's also a feasible effort. And what's super interesting is look what happens once you've invested that energy. You have, the investment on the A plot on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side. Look at what happens to the energy use in shelter. It almost vanishes. Because the thing is, we can do so much with efficiency and efficient technologies. And the problem is that the shelter sector, the dwelling sector that is so important, is not a profitable, that's this is not a profitable way for capitalism and the financial sector to invest their money. So we have a real divergence in what we should be doing and what the interest of that of the capacity, the people who have the capacity to do this investment, what they're doing. And this is a very, very large problem around the world. It's also a development problem in terms of where this investment should be happening. So it's technically possible, it's physically possible, we have the capacity to do it, we have the workforce to do it, all of these things, everything is feasible. It's just not the way our economies are oriented. What's also interesting is mobility. Obviously, mobility, you need, it's a quarter of the investment necessary. Then it becomes half of the energy use. That's because physics is real and you can't move stuff around without using energy. That's just the way things are. Okay, but have a look at that paper because it's so cool. Fact three, dependency. So this is probably where I sort of wander into areas that are less comfortable for you. So we were looking at what factors enable or disable societies from living well at low energy, and we're getting into political economy here. This is where we go back into this idea of provisioning systems. So really what we're saying is that the thing that's mediating resource use and well-being is these provisioning systems that have social, political, technical, and economic characteristics. And provisioning systems is where it's at if you want to understand how to trans what when you need to transform. So crash course on what provisioning systems, the dream and the reality. So the dream is that in fact provisioning systems could enable good lives at low resource use. The reality is that they're often engineered deliberately to do the contrary, to create resource dependency. So we have this divergence in what could happen and what should happen from a human well-being, from a social priority perspective. And one of the things to understand is this is something that is researched a lot in the social sciences, political sciences, so political economy, sociology of consumption, sociology of production. The dependency on resource consumption is itself one of the core products of the industrial age. And this is something that industries have done for decades, and in fact, like a century. We know we can study sort of a century of them behaving in this way, basically ensuring that there will always be a market for their products. And the way they do this is they use lobbying, they obtain subsidies from governments, and we have this whole phenomenon that we call state regulatory capture, where the industry forces the state to make sure that they impose conditions of resource dependency. And the United States is a beautiful example of this for car dependency, for instance, zoning laws that really impose car dependency. You cannot live without a car because everything is zoned to be miles away, separated from each other. You don't have integrated neighborhoods. You don't have any kind of public transit investment at the level that's required. And we also see it. We see it in lots of different ways. You know, parking space requirements in cities. Anyway, so the automotive industry, the fossil fuel industry in general, have been absolutely great at creating dependency on their products. And we see it in other areas as well. You know, my favorite is the recent fashion for white t-shirts, which, you know, every time you eat pasta, you have to get a new t-shirt. Okay, I'm going to skip this. You can look at it if you want later. I'm going to skip this. I'm just going to say that our studies on political economy allowed the UK rap special or the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights in his UN UK visit report to say that privatization of public services goes against human rights, and it does. Like, there are some things that cannot be left to the market because people are not able to live and be okay and healthy and safe if they do not have access to them. And that's something that our research really shows. And I'm proud of that. I am less proud of what the UK government did with that report, which was tear it up and say it wasn't based in reality. The way forward, is, I would argue, is democracy, but including economic democracy. So bringing scientifically based expertise and public deliberation, like in citizen assemblies, and also having basically have giving citizens, giving the people in a society the ability to make decisions on what should be produced, consumed, and how. I think that is really important, and we should stop pretending that the market makes good decisions for us. It makes very bad decisions for us. One of the things we did empirically, I assume you'll always care about empirical work, is that we showed that democracy is in fact one of the factors that is positive in allowing societies to do better at a given level of energy use and achieve more need satisfaction, more well-being. Other things that were great were public services, equality of income, healthcare access, and network infrastructures. Negative factors were extractivism, which is when economies are very dependent on mining and fossil fuel extraction, et cetera, and economic growth above a certain income. Okay, I'm continuing this direction of research in this new EU project, a post-growth deal. We're in the second year of it. With the lovely Yorgos Kallis and Jason Hickel in Barcelona, we're doing a bunch of stuff, including trying to make more mo do more modeling, looking at north-south convergence, those kinds of things. I am an activist as well as an academic, so I've been trying to push the case that we cannot take our job descriptions as they were written for us, and we have to intervene more strongly in the systems of power that are driving our societies into very, very bad states. We can't just sit back and let that happen and pretend that we're still doing our jobs. We have the responsibility of our knowledge. We have the responsibility of the knowledge of our colleagues. Like, if you believe what the environmental, biodiversity, climate researchers are saying, you have a responsibility to try to act on it and not just sit in offices. I think that that's quite important at this point. And I've also been reading up in the last year and a half on climate denial, disinformation, and where it comes from, which it turns out is neoliberalism. So there are these fossil fuel funded, gonna make this very quick, fossil fuel funded, fossil billionaire funded, the Koch brothers, et cetera, a network of think tanks. It's an international network. It's called the Atlas Network. It has more than 500 think tanks around the world, and they don't do any research. They just do propaganda. And their propaganda is on a variety of topics, but including very much climate denial. So that's how I came across them, is I was trying to understand where the heck this is coming from. But I found that that was just, you know, one of the things they were doing. And the other stuff that they're doing is going against democracy and going against universities and the public role of science generally. And I think that we should be paying a lot more attention to them. And that's why I wrote this blog, because who's got time for academic articles? So have a look at it if you're interested, and I'm happy to stop now, and hopefully we still have time for discussion.
Thank you so much, Julia. That was a very interesting talk, and we are also welcoming any questions if you have some. I see a few hands. If you want, you can also switch on your video and already ask the question. I see some raised, Ian, and also another one from Dwayne. Dwayne, maybe you want to go first?
Hi there. That was a fantastic talk, by the way. Very interesting, very nice avenue you put on things. So one of the things that obviously this is a HEP conference, and high energy physics is quite energy intensive, and very little emphasis is put on the energy of research in the future, because maybe it's seen as small compared to other things, but it's necessarily, some could argue that it's not necessary to do the kind of research that we do. And so how do you factor an argument into making a case for the amount of tonnage of CO2 future physics requires, for example, in comparison to what we should do to try to reduce the overall impact?
Okay. I don't know. Some of you might know this. Not only did I used to be a physicist, I'm also married to one. And there's a limit to what I can say without having getting divorced, which is extremely inconvenient, involves a lot of paperwork, as I hear. And so I will try to be diplomatic here. I think that this is always a question in terms of, there's always this question, why is science justified when children are dying of hunger? This is always sort of the thing, like, you know, should we all not be turning towards the most vulnerable? You know, shouldn't our priority always be helping people? And I think to some extent, there's an argument that yes, we should always be trying. I mean, I think socially we should be trying to turn our time, capacity, and attention to helping the most vulnerable. That's sort of my orientation. But I think that there's also an argument that of all the excesses of our society, science is not the worst one. You know, as if you look at what's happening with AI, which is a complete scandal and scam and theft and piracy and horrific working conditions causing people permanent mental health damage that makes them unable to live with their families, you know, compared with that, high energy physics is, you know, peanuts, right? So I think that it's important to ask these questions. At the same time, science does have its own justification. I do believe that science, fundamental science, has its own justification. And to make an to go even further, one of the things that's really important in my field is learning about what it means to be human. The things we've been told about what it means to be human are wrong, a lot of them. Our civilizations are very young, and they've done weird things, and they don't represent the full large spectrum of what human societies are capable of, which goes back, you know, a couple of 100,000 years. We're learning a lot from archaeology. We're learning a lot from anthropology, you know, people like David Wengrow looking at Paleolithic societies and stuff. And that's fundamental science that we absolutely need right now, because we need to know what kinds of organizations we're capable of over what time spans, just to give us a bit of courage to change things. And you know, so that research is necessary, but it's also not a very high priority. It's also something where people are like, oh, we should cut this. It's not giving people the skills they need to be employed in the modern workforce, whatever. Anyway, so I think that there is always an argument. There is always a strong argument for fundamental science of multiple different kinds to be happening. At the same time, it is very important for the scientific community to be thinking, okay, do we really need this? Is this really going to help? Or are we keeping something in motion that we could do in different ways?
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you, Julia. Ian? I think you can go next, and then Claire. I see another hand.
Yes. Okay. Thanks, Julia, for a great talk.
I couldn't help noticing that both you and Yamina Saheb, that we heard a couple of days ago at the beginning of this conference, put forward sufficiency, of course, but also as one of the main things on which you have to really act and quickly, it's housing or sheltering in your plot. Everybody knows this. You mentioned the 150 assembly in France. So those citizens a couple of years ago, they also came up with this as the first thing to do. Our politicians still are not taking it seriously. We have been hearing for tens of years, yeah, we have to invest in isolation of buildings. We have to refurbish, we have to install heat pumps and so on. They keep saying it, but nothing's happening. Is there a way forward to finally make a difference?
Julia, if you're speaking, you're muted.
Yeah,
Sorry.
so sorry, I'm sharing screens again. So that's me sitting on a motorway in Bern trying to advocate for renovation in Switzerland. So that was with Renovate Switzerland. We all got arrested, et cetera. And I mean, that was the thing that we were trying to do is we were just trying to say, this should be the priority. It's socially a really important priority. It's economically a really important priority. It gives t local jobs, all of this stuff. It should be something, in theory, it's something that all politicians across all parties agree to do, and they still don't create the conditions for it to happen. And so this was, sort of our desperate effort to do this. And I think our campaign made the topic a lot more important in the media. I'm not sure if it's really a few local initiatives were bolstered by it, et cetera. I think we did make a difference, but honestly, it's a source of desperation as to how, win, 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 win something can be. But if it's not the priority of the fossil fuel lobby, oh, and by the way, our energy minister in Switzerland is a climate denying a fo career fossil fuel lobbyist named Albert Rösti, who looks adorable on camera. He has such a nice smile. Anyway, but so we're in this real trouble. And we do not know how to get out of it. And this is why I think that it's really important for scientists to, including physicists, anybody with a brain, please join us, come and participate in this effort of understanding who the lobby groups are, how they're acting, how they're interacting, and really stopping our political and economic system from doing the things we should be doing, because it's a scandal. Yeah.
Claire, you can go ahead.
Hey, but can you hear me okay? Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Professor Steinberger, for your work. It's admirable, and I really appreciate the activism part of your activities. My question is pragmatic. I'm sure a lot of people in this room want to also act on this activism point of view. It turns out, and you know, because you've been at CERN, we're pretty busy. I recall a lot of demonstration and such. I can't because there is a key meeting, and then the students will be impacted, like act of presence that makes us limited in time. But yet the wheel is here, right? And I'm sure we can create a virtuous circle of more scientists turning activists, inspiring other scientists to become activists. What would be the best, most impactful activities for people who are actually very limited in time due to their work commitment? Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah. So there's a couple of things. One is the busyness is not just a researcher problem, right? I mean, people are the imperatives of modern life are very, very strong in terms of like, oh, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. There's this thing, there's that thing. Like, a lot of people are working multiple jobs or part of the gig economy or just sort of caught into a lot of different activities that they think they need to be doing. And I think that I really, really think it is very important. The first thing you do in physics, right, is you try to understand what your zeroth order issue is, and then the first order, and so on. You take a step back and you look at the whole thing. And one of the things you have to ask yourself is, am I spending my time in the way I want to be spending it, given what I know? And if you need to, I'm working 80%, partly So my partly because it's necessary for reasons of health, and taking care of my kid and so on, but partly because that allows my university not to fire me when I decide to spend one day doing activism and get arrested. They can always say, "Oh, but she wasn't, that was not one of her working days," you know? So I think if that is possible for you, and that is some, you know, creating the time to do important stuff and creating the space to do important stuff is something that social justice activists, workers, whatever you want to call them, people throughout time have always found a way to do. If honestly, if the slaves in Haiti, like we have no excuse. If the slaves in Haiti could mount a revolt and kick out the French, we can do this, right? They were working on plantations where the life expectancy was way less than 30 years. So I think that this is just something where we have to decide what priorities are and how to organize ourselves according to our obligations. But we live in circumstances where a lot of us have that capacity. In terms of what, you know, going back to your actual question, how can researchers contribute? I think there's a lot of research to be done. If you want to look at the Atlas Network, it would be great. Like, look at these organizations, figure out who's in them. There's a lot of like data scraping. Looking, you know, I've been imploring, you know, master's students to do this kind of work. Like, it look at who's connected to who on LinkedIn. Look at which journalists have participated in their freedom summer schools where they learn climate denial and Ayn Rand worship, and figure out what articles those people have then subsequently written in their mainstream journalist careers where they actually put climate denial into lay talking points. Like, you have research capacities that are extraordinarily valuable. You have data synthesis capacities that are extraordinarily valuable. So you can contribute to this. There's a lot of work to be done from, you know, your desk late at night, having fun sort of playing with this data and information. So, but I think that science communication would have, I would probably have answered that science communication is a really important direction, you know, maybe 10 years ago, like help communicate the science of climate change, you know, make things that people can use in primary schools or secondary schools, make those kinds of materials. I think now that the knowledge gap is much less on the science part, although that still exists, and much more on the sort of economic and political manipulation, and the threats that all scientists are facing. I mean, the Atlas Network and the Neoliberal Project hates universities. It hates publicly funded research of all stripes, certain types more than others. But that's really one of the things that they're trying to do is undermine the place of public science, full stop, and in various ways. And so I think that that's something that we should be paying a lot more attention to and communicating a lot more about. And I think that there is that role for sort of research, data analysis, synthesis, and communicating that with client with the movements that don't have that capacity themselves, which could be really important.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. If nobody wants to go ahead, I have a few questions. In your one of your last slides, you had you just mentioned that democracy, like decision making based on democracy, should work with the public services. But I do have this question where people are not in places where people are not like climate denial, but climate ignorance, because this is somehow I do also face during conversations where it's always like, yeah, climate change, we know everything, but it's not my problem, or it's not my problem today, and we can deal with it later, and that goes on like later. And it's not like the foremost or one of the foremost things that people do talk about, and how do we address that and make people more aware?
So when people are, again, okay, I almost don't know where to start. 100 years ago, give or take, the fossil fuel industry in the person of Rockefeller and Standard Oil had real public relations problems, and they founded the public relations industry. And all the messaging that you hear from climate, all the things that you're hearing from these other people, they don't come up with that themselves. They might think, oh, this is my original contrarian, whatever, original thought on this matter. But they're getting that messaging from media, they're getting that messaging from social media, and when you follow the sort of, the fake news and the propaganda upstream and the sort of messaging frames upstream, you end up with these public relations firms and these allied think tanks that do things like, for instance, they've created curriculum materials in economics for secondary school that pretty much everybody gets. And one of the things that they've been doing is they've been pushing climate denial, but that works less among some people now. And then they started pushing climate delay. So we called it the discourses of climate delay. And so that's one of the things that we just went around and categorized them. So you can have a look at at that article in terms of what we did. And if you there's actually a comic strip version and a whole bunch of other versions. I can probably find the comic version somewhere where we actually made cartoons of them. And so I think that that's one of the fun ways, if you want to deal with it on a sort of visual level and sort of tell people, hey, what you're saying is actually fits in these discourses of climate delay. And by the way, it doesn't come from you. This is something that, I mean, I kind of hate to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but this is not a conspiracy. It is factually founded. Like, we know so much about this history. We know about Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway's work on Merchants of Doubt. Oh yeah, I should plug their work. So there's these beautiful historians of science, Naomi Oreskes and Eric Conway. They've written two really important books. The second one is quite recent. It just came out last year. So there's Merchants of Doubt is the first one, and which is on the climate denial industry. And the second one is The Big Myth, which is on neoliberalism and in the US context, including these Atlas Network think tanks, and how that's been driving climate denial and climate delay. And so I think the thing to understand is really where this messaging comes from. And one of the things that you have to understand, and I think climate scientists, on the natural science side understood too late, is that you don't counter propaganda on a factual discussion. So you don't, if you're saying, if people are saying, oh, CO2 doesn't cause climate change, and you're like, oh, yes, it does, and you're getting into that debate, the only thing that you're doing is you're legitimizing the debate. What you have to do is you have to attack them at the level of their strategy as to what they're trying to do. And what they're trying to do is slow down action because they're trying to get a few more years of profit, like the fossil fuel industry. So you have to say, okay, I know what you're trying to do. You're just trying to slow things down. And so I think that it's really important to understand the whole machinery of where this messaging comes from. And we don't get anywhere if we don't try to attack it at the source. If we just attack it argument by argument by argument, we're just sort of in this losing sort of hamster wheel where we don't have the propaganda tools that they have. And so we really need to be a lot more strategic about what we're doing there, I think. And I'll try to find the cartoon image because it's fun. While we talk to Shreya.
Shreya, I'll go ahead and ask my question. Is that okay? Thank you, Professor. It was a really good talk. And I just have a general question. Like in high energy physics, as we know it, say since the past 20 years and even now, we are moving more towards AI. Like we are building, for example, something I also am involved in, like foundational models, something like the ChatGPT. Like we are going towards that zone. I just want to know, and a lot of companies I read up online, they try to say that there is sustainability may be accelerated because of AI. I'm just curious if there is a balance we can reach as a society, or is it just a greenwash?
I'm
That's
sorry,
all.
I didn't understand the last part of the question.
The last part is, so I just want to know, can we reach a balance between developments in AI and sustainability and climate change, or is it going to be a disaster, which I am more towards the disaster side, but I just want to know if that's something possible.
So AI, well, I mean, So I think first of all, I think it's important to be careful when we talk about AI what we mean, because there's certain tools like various types of machine learning or whatever that are probably okay. I mean, you always have to think, am I using the right tool for the right thing? Am I over-engineering this, or am I using too much resources for something that could be done in a different way? I think we always have to think about that. In terms, and I don't think it's intelligent. I think that it's pretty clear it's not. And so it's also about not contributing to industry hype. It's also because the very name and artificial intelligence is a complete misnomer. And it's they reproduce patterns, right? That's all they do, and sometimes not very well. But I think it's really important to also understand what that industry is doing, so the political economy of it and who's being supported by that industry. So you saw how all the tech bros, they all sort of pretended to be a bit progressive at some point. Maybe they were never really. Now they're definitely on the pro-fascist side, supporting Trump, supporting surveillance state, just like, again, being part of this project of disabling democracy. And I went as far as to write a whole Guardian column about this. So I'll drop that in that link in the chat. But it's a bigger discussion, and I think that what's probably more important is how these technologies are being used to as an excuse to take power. So AI is being used as an excuse to destroy the civil service, the capacity of a government to employ people to do things for each other, because they're basically saying AI will do it, so allow us to fire everybody while we take funds for our stupid projects. And cryptocurrency, again, there's this whole hype of, oh, it's this free pirate currency or whatever. The reality of it is it's a tool to discipline government. Again, it's a tool to disable democracy in the sense that it allows mass scale corruption, money laundering, and it makes it impossible for governments to collect taxes, right? So at a very basic level, it's just going to only allow rich people to do what they want and do mass scale corruption. So I think we always have to be aware of the hype versus the reality. Fortunately, there's some very good researchers and journalists who are looking at this stuff, and it's really important to understand to follow their work. So there's one of the great ones is Gil Duran. So if you and I mentioned him, so Gil Duran is doing really great work. He's got this website called The Nerd Reich, and again, just be aware of who you're allied with, because they're destroying universities and science on a mass scale, and it's not funny. So even more important than the tool itself and the use of the tool, it's also who's lying behind it and what their agenda is, sadly.
Thank you very much, Professor.
So, yeah, we will take one more final question. So, Greg, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Julia, for your talk. You commented in a few minutes ago that trying to bring scientific argument to climate denial only legitimizes the denial, and I see that in my interactions. And one of the things I've tried to do with some students is to go about it a slightly different way. We're now in an environment where people are starting to talk glibly about the possibility of nuclear war over Ukraine and things like that. And one of the things that I've recently said in a talk was consider Larsen C, the Larsen C ice shelf, which broke off from Antarctica a few years ago. It was around 1,200 cubic kilometers of ice, and that moved northward and gradually melted away, reduced the planet's albedo in its departure, that kind of thing. The amount of energy taken to melt that ice is more than the entire stockpile of the world's nuclear weapons, and we've got something like 10,000 megatons of TNT equivalent in stockpiled nuclear weapons. That might have some value as a shock sidestep to this this problem of bringing scientific argument against climate denial. You can shock people with the militaristic equivalence, and I don't know whether that's something we should be trying to do. I mean, on a practical level, you could even argue maybe we should anchor ice shelves that are about to break off so that they don't break off and drift north and reduce the planet's albedo and participate in this positive feedback effect, which you don't want. I don't know what people think about bringing in the militaristic argument. It might be something more people can identify with or accept than scientific arguments we'd like to bring.
So, in terms of climate denial, I think so. I guess maybe the most effective counter argument is the link I just put in the chat. In my view, which is that I don't see why people bother pretending to believe in climate denial anymore when we have the scientific evidence that the fossil fuel industry themselves had excellent climate models that predicted warming better than university and IPCC models did up until like a decade ago. And Jeffrey Supran, Naomi Oreskes, and Stefan Rahmstorf were able to show that in the Science article. So the fossil fuel industry had great climate models in the 70s and 80s, fantastic. Okay, and they knew what they were doing, and they just caused a few fools to think otherwise. So I think for me, that's the biggest argument is just the disinformation argument. Climate denial is industrial disinformation. Anybody who they don't believe it themselves. Okay, so why does anybody else bother? That would be my first port of call. I think that comparisons along the one that you made. I think you know everything that sort of. Any factual statement that sort of helps people realize sort of the magnitude of what's going on is helpful. I would not rely on those alone because we're facing this big political and economic problem, and in the end, what we're facing is not people's scientific understanding; it's the interests of this industry and the industries allied with it. And until we're willing to face them. And come up with and be very direct about the fact that we're faced that you know it's an existential crisis of us versus these industries and what they've been doing to us. I don't think we're going to make much progress with scientific arguments alone. That's my view.
Thank you very much for the excellent talk and this discussion. Professor, so I think in the interest of time, we will move forward to the next session and we would like to thank you again and hopefully hear you sometime again and hope you could stay for some sessions if you have time and if you'd like to. So we would like to move forward to the next session of submitted talks. So the first talk is on countering the biodiversity loss using particle physics research sites. So Julian, please go ahead and share your screen.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.